Good evening. It's February 29th, 2016. We're in Gainesville, Florida at the Gainesville Retreat Center. And tonight's sutta will be Majjhima Nikaya number 10, the Satipatthana Sutta.
This particular sutta is one of the more misunderstood suttas. A lot of people refer to it, but it doesn't quite go up to their definitions of things. Thus have I heard on one occasion, a Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kama Sadama. There he addressed the monks thus. "Monks, venerable sir," they replied. The Blessed One said this: "Monks, this is a direct path for the purification of beings, for surmounting sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain, grief, and fear, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness." What are the four? Here, monks, a monk abides. Now, in this translation, he uses the word contemplation, and I don't like that because that implies thinking about. And I change that to observation. Observation of the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing, feeling as feeling, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing mind as mind, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides observing mind objects as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now we're going to go into the observation of the body. And the first part is the instructions in mindfulness of breathing. I don't want you to do this meditation, but I want you to hear it. And how, monks, does a monk abide observing the body as a body? Here a monk gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or an empty hut sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, sets his body erect and establishes mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful he breathes in, mindful he breathes out. Breathing in long, he understands I breathe on long. Breathing out long, he understands I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he understands I breathe in short. Or, breathing out short, he understands I breathe out short. Now, did you hear me mention nostril, upper lip, or abdomen? No, because that's not what you are doing. You understand when you take a long breath and when you take a short breath. You understand when the breath is subtle and when it's very gross. So the key word here is understand. It doesn't say focus on, it doesn't say only take the breath as your object of meditation. It just says you understand when you take a long breath or short breath. Now we get into the actual instruction in the meditation. And I say that because of these next three words. He trains thus. Okay, now you're doing the meditation. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. Bhikkhu Bodhi, when he first did this translation, in brackets, he had "of breath." And I questioned him on that. And he said, actually, I did that because his teacher, Jnanapanika, kind of insisted that it be in like that. The second edition of this, he took it out. And it makes you think, when you see the whole body of breath, that you're supposed to be focusing on the breath. And actually what you're doing is using the breath as a reminder to tranquilize your bodily formation. And I'll get to that in just a moment. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. What I found is that almost everybody, in the West at least, but an awful lot of Asians too, they consider the body from the neck down. And they consider mind from the neck up. But actually, this is part of your body, your whole body. Now, when you... we get back to what craving is, okay? Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind. The way you recognize craving when it arises is the tightness that happens around your brain and actually spine. But I just focus on the brain because that's enough. The meninges is a bag that goes around your brain and it doesn't move. But every time you have a thought, every time you have a feeling, every time there is a sensation that arises, your brain expands a little bit and it causes subtle tightness or tension in your head and in your whole body. So when it's talking about tranquilizing the bodily formation, what it's actually talking about is recognizing that tightness that in around your brain and your spine both, but relaxing. What happens when you do that? When you relax this tension and tightness in your head, which is subtle. And I know from my own experience that when I first started meditating and for the first 20 years, I ignored that slight tension and tightness. I didn't understand it. But there are times when you practice one-pointed concentration, when you don't recognize this tension and tightness, that there can be major tightness that happens in your head. When I was practicing straight vipassana, I got to the fourth insight, knowledge. And it was just like somebody took a hot needle, red hot needle, and just stuck it in the middle of my head. I had immense pain. And of course I went to the teacher and I'm going, this is bad. I don't like this. This really hurts. Oh, they're very happy because I'm seeing the rise and fall and all of this kind of things that they have in their insight knowledges. interesting thing about the insight knowledges is you don't find them in the suttas. That's only from commentary. Now, in Pali, there is a word that describes the tranquilizing. And it can be a noun, it can be an adjective, it can be a verb, it can be an adverb, depending on the words used in front of this word. And this word, these three words, he trains thus, tells you that this is an action verb. This is something that you're supposed to be doing on the in-breath and on the out-breath. I have talked with a lot of people that have done one-pointed concentration, and they say, my mind is tranquilized. But that's not what this is talking about. It's about relaxing on the in-breath and relaxing on the out-breath. Using the breath as a reminder to relax. Now, when you do that, the meninges goes in between. There's two layers of meninges in between your brain, your different brain lobes. As you start doing that, you will actually start feeling a letting go of the tensions and tightnesses in your brain. You'll start feeling it. And you'll feel it go down. But when you don't use the relax step, you don't see this tension and tightness that happens in your brain. Now, there's a couple of things that happen because you don't see it. One, you let go of your distraction and immediately come back to your object of meditation. In other words, you're bringing that craving back to your object of meditation, because you didn't see it. A lot of people practice meditation for years, and they will complain that, well, you're supposed to be more relaxed. You're not supposed to have so much anger come up. You're not supposed to have so many emotional problems come up. But they do, and they're very strong. And what I found from doing straight vipassana was, over the years, my mind became super critical. Somebody would come up and they'd tell me about their practice. You don't know what you're doing. It's not like that. But when you start noticing that tension and tightness and start relaxing, you start letting go of hindrances. Now, when you're doing one-pointed concentration, the force of the concentration suppresses the hindrances, doesn't allow them to come up. But when the concentration goes away, the hindrances come up and they're a lot stronger. I read a magazine on meditation, and the editor was writing about having to run home from having a hard day at work and finally getting so he could sit down and meditate and be peaceful. Well, that's not what the Buddha was talking about. You don't just get peaceful while you're in that concentration. When you use the relaxed step, you become more and more balanced. And as a result, you start recognizing hindrances in your daily life, and you start 6R-ing those. And when you do that, your mind becomes more peaceful and calm. So the instructions in mindfulness of breathing are not followed. You go to a lot of different teachers of mindfulness of breathing. Put your attention on your nostril tip. Well, it doesn't mention that here. Focus on that. Keep your attention on that only. One-pointed concentration. You see, when you're doing the 6 R's, that relaxed step stops your mind from becoming one-pointed. And you become much more aware all the time. Aware of what your mind is doing while you're doing it. And smiling helps your mindfulness to improve. Why? Because you have a tendency to have more joy come up in your mind while you're smiling. And joy is a very necessary part of this practice. When you have joy in your mind is very clear, your mind is very bright and alert. So when the joy starts fading away, you can recognize that, I'm getting caught with this hindrance. And you can use the 6 R's and let it go and continue on with what you're doing. Now, just because you use the 6 R's once or twice doesn't mean a hindrance is going to go away necessarily. You might have to work with it for a while. Every time you let go of that craving, you relax and come back to your wholesome states, your smile, your object of meditation, and staying on your object of meditation, you're improving your mindfulness. So just because you have a hindrance come up and you say, "Oh, I can't meditate anymore because I just am so caught up in this stuff." You're getting caught in the content of your hindrances. And we don't care why things happen. We don't care whether you like them or not. The Buddha was interested in how your mind's attention moves from one thing to another. How does that happen? Why? You can go to psychologists for years, and they'll tell you the same thing every time you see them, until finally you get tired of paying all this money out, and then you start looking for something else that works. This does work. But you have to be patient with it. I was with Sayadaw Usilananda for 2 years. I was his attendant. I was with him every day. I took care of all of his needs. I gave him food every day. I found out what his personal preferences were and made sure those happened. I spent a long time with him, and he kept telling me over and over and over, patience leads to Nibbana. So much so that I got tired of hearing and started complaining about it, and he started laughing. He thought it was great fun. So it doesn't work. Well, are you practicing patiently? are you just saying, I don't care what this nonsense is my mind is bringing up right now. I don't care whether it's painful or not. It's just a feeling. Did you sit and say, well, I'm supposed to be mad right now? You're not going to do that to yourself. It comes up because conditions are right for it to arise. It's not yours. You can't make it come up. Well, you can try. You can't make it stop. You can't make it go away. So you got no control over it. So the only thing you can do is allow it to be there. It's okay for it to be there. Has to be okay. Because it's there. That's the truth. You can't fight with the truth. If you do, who's causing their own suffering? Well, he said this, and I'm mad. Who cares what he said? Who's making themselves unhappy? Who's causing their own pain? Who's making other people around them unhappy? I am. It's mine, but it's your fault. One of the things I truly love about Buddhism is the self-responsibility. You can't blame anybody else for your suffering. Your suffering is caused by you because you're taking your thoughts and your feelings personally and you're not liking it. And then you're trying to think this painful feeling away. And that's where your habitual tendency is to get caught up in emotional states. Causing yourself immeasurable amounts of suffering. But you can't blame somebody else for your suffering. You have to take responsibility for yourself and say, well, this is here, it's true, and it's real. But I don't have to take it personally. All I have to do is let it be there by itself, not keep my attention on it. It's only a painful feeling. It's only painful thoughts. They don't have anything to do with me. I didn't ask them to come up. So you have to allow it to be. Relax that tightness caused by that. Smile? I don't feel like smiling. I hurt. Who hurts? Who doesn't feel like it? A lot of people come and they'll tell me, oh, I can't meditate right now. I have so much stuff going on in my mind. Who has so much stuff going on in their mind? Who doesn't like it? Who's causing their own pain and suffering? I. Where's the I come from? Craving. It's a pleasant feeling, I like it. It's a painful feeling, I don't like it. I. And then you got all of your stories and concepts and opinions and ideas. And right after that, your habitual tendency of reacting. When this kind of feeling comes up, and these kind of stories and thoughts and opinions come up, then I always act that way. I always get fearful. I always get sad. I always get frustrated. And I take that as, this is me. And it's painful, and I don't like it. See how crazy your mind is? It's okay to be crazy. Everybody is. The only people that aren't crazy are arahats. Everybody else in the world is crazy because they take everything personally. But when you start seeing this as a process that's impersonal, you don't have any control over this stuff. When it comes up, it's going to come up when it comes up. When you allow it to be there without keeping your attention on it, that's the key. And then relax. Now, for a brief moment, your mind is clear, your mind is bright, your mind is very alert, and your mind is pure. And bring that pure mind back to your smile. Keep it light. Now, some people today have been talking about how they're trying to make something happen and it doesn't work. Well, you're putting in too much energy, too much effort. I am trying to control. Well, I'm not there. That's just a false belief. I told you a couple days ago, I want you to smile, I want you to laugh, I want you to have fun. Don't get serious with this stuff. There's nothing to be serious about. It's just nonsense going through mind. Instead of reacting, like you always act when this kind of feeling comes up, now you use the 6R and you start responding with a clear mind that truly understands how this process works. I can teach mindfulness of breathing. I mean, I've done it for so long. But I prefer not to teach mindfulness of breathing for a couple of reasons. Almost everybody starts out with mindfulness of breathing. And they develop these habits. And then when I come along and say, okay, relax on the in-breath, relax on the out-breath, distraction, let it be, relax, smile, come back to your object. On the in-breath, relax, on the out-breath, relax. You'll forget it. And it takes a long time. I say a long time, 6 weeks. To me, 6 weeks is really a long time. And I'm somebody that has done, I've done about a dozen three-month retreats. I did an eight-month retreat in Burma. I did a two-year retreat in Burma. I've meditated for long periods of time. But after finding out what the Buddha was actually saying, if you come to the center and you spend more than 2 weeks, I'm going to put you to work doing stuff because you know how your mind works. You start to get the idea that there's everything you do in your life is part of meditation. I even wrote a book called Life, or Meditation is Life, Life is Meditation. There's no time during the day when you can't observe what you're doing with your mind. You see there's some tension and tightness there. Your mind is thinking all kinds of crazy thoughts running around here and there. 6R it right then. If you develop the habit of smiling and smiling and a little smiling, your mindfulness is going to get so sharp, and you're starting to observe more and more closely how this process works. Strangers are going to come up to you and say, "You're so peaceful and calm. I want some of that. What are you doing?" The people that you work with, "Well, you've changed. I like it. What are you doing?" A lot of people also, they tell me they want to be, "I want to be a teacher." And they ask me, what do you have to do to be a teacher? It's reasonably easy. You have to keep your precepts without breaking them and be the example of what it is to have a happy mind. That's how you teach. You want to affect the world around you in a positive way? Smile. Laugh. Radiate some loving kindness. And Boulder Creek, there's a place called, let's see if I can remember, Heart Math. Okay. And they have machines that measure very subtle energies. And they started finding out that loving kindness is really a good thing. So they started measuring it. And they said people that just start practicing loving kindness, it affects, that energy affects about a 500-foot radius around you, which means everybody else gets some benefit from that too. But Usilananda, while he was still alive, had a stroke right after I became a monk and I was in Thailand. And I heard about it. So every day I would spend an hour, 2 hours radiating loving kindness to him, so his mind was clear and accepting. His mind was uplifted and happy. A couple of weeks later, he writes me a letter and thanks me for sending him loving kindness. You want to affect the world around you in a positive way? Guess what? Let go of this belief that every thought is me, it's mine. Use the 6 R's. Carry the 6 R's with you as closely as you carry your skin. Use it whenever you can remember. You will affect the world around you in a positive way. There's so much fear and anxiety and greed and hatred in the world right now. You can't overcome that with anything but loving acceptance. And you have to start with number one. Well, that sounds really selfish. The Buddha said, if you truly love yourself, you will never harm another being. So when you practice meditation, meditation is not just about sitting. The first part of meditation is practicing your generosity. Uh-oh, the monk's talking about generosity. Watch out for your wallet. How can you give something to somebody else if you don't have it yourself? You send loving kindness to yourself, then you can give that loving kindness away. How? Smile. Simple. Radiate some loving kindness. Simple. While you're walking, why do you think I want you to do the walking meditation? In a normal pace, like you walk every day. So when you get off of retreat and you're going from here to your car or you're walking down the street, what are you doing with your mind? Ho-hum. Thinking this, thinking that, not paying attention to anything in particular. Well, don't do that. Start radiating loving kindness. I had a student in Australia, and he wrote to me, he said, I've been practicing one-pointed concentration for 7 years, and I don't see any real personality change. Can you show me how to do the meditation so that I start being more happy all the time? And I said, yeah, of course. That's easy. So I gave him the instructions and mindfulness of breathing, and he would forget. And after a little while, I saw that that wasn't going to work. So I said, okay, I don't want you to do mindfulness of breathing anymore. I want you to practice loving kindness. And I gave him the instructions in loving kindness. But when he was getting deep in his concentration, it was suppressing the hindrances. With loving kindness meditation, the way I'm showing you, it doesn't suppress anything. So he had hindrances coming up, and boy, did he complain. I'm going back to the breath. At least I'm peaceful and calm. And I got tired of his belly aching. So I said, okay, I want you to stop all sitting for 1 week. What I want you to do is smile all the time. When you don't feel like smiling, I want you to laugh. And I just said, okay, that's it. And I didn't hear from him for a week. And I thought, well, he's just gone on his way, done other things. And he writes back and he said, I really took what you said to heart. And this is what happened to me. When I started smiling all the time, when I was walking, I always had my head down and I was in this hazy world, ho-hum, thinking this, thinking that. And when I started smiling, my posture started getting better and I started walking with a lighter mind. And one of the darndest things happened. As I was walking, people started smiling back at me. He said, that never happens. And even when it was hard to smile, I smiled anyway. And there was real benefit from doing that. Then he said something that kind of shook me up. He said, and now my doctor is making my medicines less. And I said, medicines? He said, yes, I'm in a mental institute. I have bipolar really bad. Oh. I said, have you noticed whether your mindfulness is any better or not? He said, I didn't even know what mindfulness was. I've been practicing meditation for 7 years, and I didn't know. Now I'm much more aware of everything. When he went into the mental institute, he was told he was going to be staying there for the rest of his life. After 6 months, he was doing so much better and taking so much less drugs that they let him out. Is loving kindness healing? Absolutely. And He still affects people in a positive way when he remembers that he needs to smile. So the importance of smiling, yeah, it's big, especially with your daily activities. Now, I've been going to Indonesia, and I have a lady that is very, very good in English. And she's a translator into Bahasa, Indonesia. So she has to sit with me when I'm giving interviews to people, because a lot of people don't speak English. And we giggle and laugh all day. And we're not laughing at anything. When we hear somebody is finally letting go of something, then we start laughing. Yeah, that's right. Good one. Now you're starting to understand. And now people start coming in and they start saying, "It feels so good to be in this room with you guys." Well, of course it does. We love everybody that comes in, and we're extremely happy when they're successful. It makes us kind of giggly, kind of laughing all the time. So the smiling is an important aspect of this, because it does improve your mindfulness, and you really start to understand more deeply what mindfulness truly is. So, I want you to smile more. Ah, but I smile all the time. That's what you think. I want you to smile more. But I don't feel like smiling. I had a student that she was very highly emotional, and she got into some kind of emotional upset. And I walked by her and I said, "Why don't you laugh?" "I can't laugh now. I'm really upset." And as soon as she said that, I started laughing. And because I started laughing, she started laughing. And then I said, "How's your mind feel now?" "Oh, yeah, that's good. Okay, thanks, Bhante. I'll see you later." Life is supposed to be fun, not supposed to be serious. And I give all of you permission to have fun. How's that? A lot of people like to have permission to do things. I give you complete permission to smile all the time and have fun. Why? Makes your meditation easier. Your progress in the meditation is a lot easier. And your understanding grows by leaps and bounds when you do this. So the mindfulness of breathing, the way it's being taught, doesn't agree with what it says in the suttas. And my teacher, Usilananda, wrote a book on the Satipatthana Sutta, and he said, "This is from the commentary." And I got to the place in the book where it starts talking about tranquilizing the bodily formation, and he just whips right through that and goes to something else. And I went to him as a monk and I said, "Bhante, why did you do that?" "Well, the commentary isn't very clear on this." "Well, why don't we just go to the sutta and see how clear it can be?" 1995, I wrote my first book. It was called The Anapanasati Sutta. And I gave him a copy. And he read it. And then I went to discuss some of the things in the book with him. And he said, you know, what you're teaching is exactly right. But I can't teach that way. I've been teaching this other way for 45 years. I can't change. If I change, all of my students are going to lose confidence in what I'm saying. But I want you to do that. I want you to teach that. Well, I'd been doing that Vipassana meditation for 20 years, and I wasn't satisfied with the end results. So my natural curiosity is I got to find out what the Buddha was talking about. I'm just a dumb American. I don't know what the Buddha was teaching. So I had to go to the suttas to find out. But I didn't understand the suttas, because I was still using a commentary and it didn't agree with what it said in the suttas, and it was confusing. So I kept going back to the commentary, slow learner, until I ran across a monk that asked me how I was teaching loving kindness. And I told him, and he said, you're teaching it exactly right, but you're using the language of the Visuddhimagga. Put the Visuddhimagga on the shelf and just go to the suttas. When I did that, all of a sudden, I was very strongly understanding what the Buddha was talking about, because I didn't have this other book blocking me, thinking that that was the one that I needed to be studying. And then I started, I have dyslexia, which means that things jump around sometimes when I'm reading. And I wanted to overcome the dyslexia, so I started reading out loud. And I decided to try that with some students that had been coming to me for loving kindness meditation. And as soon as I started reading the suttas, all of a sudden their progress in the meditation just started zooming. I told you before that the Thai think it takes 15 years. The Sri Lankans I talked to said it takes 10. And these students that I'm reading the sutta, they're getting into the jhanas in 2 days, 3 days. And I'm going, wow, there's really something different here. Let's keep doing that. And that's how so many people become successful with the meditation, because I do spend time showing you what the Buddha said. It's not my ideas. It's his. Okay, let's get back to this. Then the next part of the Satipatthana Sutta talks about the four postures. Standing, sitting, walking, laying down. And when I was practicing straight Vipassana, the teacher would say, when you're doing your walking meditation and you come and you stop at the end of your walk, note that you're standing, 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 standing. And then turning, 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 and then walking back. And I that was always stupid to me. Do you know whether you're standing or sitting? Do you know when you lie down? Do you have to remind yourself, well, I don't know what I'm doing now, so I better note it? So I've always been rather skeptical of that practice of the four postures. Except when you're sitting, stay with your object of meditation. When you're walking, stay with your object of meditation. If you want to do a standing meditation, which I really don't recommend because it's hard on the feet, then stay with your object of meditation. When you lie down, stay with your object of meditation. A story, when I was in, I think I was in Thailand, I'm not real sure. No, it must have been Burma. I decided that I was going to go out into the forest and do a standing meditation. And so everything was going along fine, and after about a half an hour, I start feeling this thing coming up my leg. And I looked down, and it was a cobra. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. And I didn't move, because if I moved, he was going to get me. So I put my hand down and I said, you don't want to go any higher. You want to get off. And he turned around and went off. This is remarkable. So I decided standing meditation in the forest was not good for your health. So I didn't recommend it. But if you're going to do a standing meditation, it's good to be by a wall or a chair, because when you close your eyes, you'll have a tendency to lose your balance. So you need to be by something so you can hold your balance. But if you do it for very long, it really does cause a lot of pain to arise. So I really do recommend sitting is a better meditation. Okay, now we get to full awareness. Again, monks, a monk is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Full awareness of what? Staying with your object of meditation while you're doing these things. You radiate loving kindness to your friend while you're putting on a coat. Pretty easy. You radiate loving kindness while you're eating. So that's what full awareness is talking about here. Now the next part of this is something that I need to have you around if you're going to do this meditation, because you can really become repulsed with your body if you're not careful. And the only people I give this meditation to are people that are really caught up in lust, which is maybe 3% of the population. But I'll let you hear what it is anyway. Again, monks, a monk reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair. Bounded by skin, as full of many impurities thus. In this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinew, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. And you're supposed to take each one of these and picture them in your mind and then relax into it. When I was teaching in Malaysia, I had a lot of college students, and they were 19, 20, 21, and their hormones were raging. And they would complain about having a lot of lust. So instead of having them do this meditation, what I did was, I said, any time you see a beautiful body walk by and you start to feel lust come up, in your mind, turn their body inside out. Hey, you really got a beautiful liver. I truly appreciate your pus. See what it does with your mind? Now you don't have lust in your mind. So I told everybody, turn these bodies inside out when you have lust. What is beautiful about the body? There's nothing. Because I was a monk, I got to do a lot of real interesting things, and one of the things that I got to do a few times is go into autopsies, where they start cutting the body up and taking out the heart and the liver and weighing it and seeing whether it's diseased or... And it was really interesting. Now, the one time that I went, this lady, just a few hours before I got there, had died of a brain hemorrhage, a stroke. So I get to go in, and they're cutting us up and pulling out the ribs and taking out the heart and weighing it and taking a look to see whether it's really diseased or not. And it's real interesting. But while I was watching this, I'm thinking, okay, those same things are in this. Where am I? Am I there? And then they decided they wanted to see what happened in the brain. So they cut the scalp all the way around like this, and they took the scalp and they flipped it onto the face, took a bone saw, sawed through the bone, popped the skull off, and you could see right where there was a bloody spot, right where one of the blood vessels had popped. And they were real interested in what one it was and that sort of thing, so they were taking the brain and they were slicing it up. And, well, I'm not there. Where am I? Interesting. Then when they got done with that body, they brought in another one of a woman that had been in a car accident, and she was 9 months pregnant, and both the baby and the mother died. So I got to see them take the baby out of the womb, and they did the autopsy on the baby too. and the lungs were like really pink and beautiful. And it was, well, where am I? And a monk that I was with, he says, you have a real strange look on your face. I said, I'm just trying to figure this out. I've been claiming this thing to be me my whole life, but where am I? So it was real interesting to be able to have that kind of experience. And to realize that there's nothing special about this. Now, at one time, while I was in Asia, there was a lot of problems with Catholic fathers getting caught with sexual activities with different people. And some Catholic fathers came to me and they said, well, do you have this kind of problem? No, not with monks. Why? Well, if you're trained properly as a monk, one of the first things you do is the foulness of the body meditation. And you don't have lust coming up. And they said, oh, that sounds so horrible. Well, it's not. I mean, there was a time that this courtesan that had a heart attack and died. And somebody told the Buddha that this courtesan, she got $1,000 a night because she could sing and dance and do all the things that they did. And the Buddha said, oh, good. Don't cremate her right now. Don't bury her. Just let her sit there. And 3 days later, they're going to the Buddha going, this corpse really stinks. We got to get rid of it. And the Buddha called everybody into the village. Okay, let's go have a lesson. And he said, this courtesan got $1,000 a night. Who will give me $500? Of course, nobody's going to. Who will give me $100? Who will give me $50? Nobody's going to buy it. Well, what's so different about her right now and 4 days ago? That body that everybody was so enthralled with, it's the same body. So why don't you rent it now? And of course, the villagers are kind of getting green around the gills, and it's really not nice being around rotting bodies. And they did cremate her after that. But the point is, why do you get so caught up in sensual desire? It's all mental. And if you really look at the body, your body stinks. Attachment to hair. Well, take some of your hair, cut it off, put it in a bowl, let it sit there for a few days, and put it in your soup. How much do you want to eat that? How do you like the smell of it? It's just not so good. There's nothing beautiful about the body. But it's a mental hindrance that can really stop you from progressing in your meditation if you see the body as being beautiful. So if any of you have lust arising in this retreat, just turn the body inside out and show me where it's beautiful, okay? Now the next part of the Satipatthana Sutta is the cemetery meditations. And we're not able to do that, except we can do it in Bali. They still, because it's a Hindu island, they still take the body to a charnel ground. And when somebody dies, the family is supposed to come to the charnel ground and take care of them, either cremate them or bury them, do whatever they want with them. Sometimes the family can't come for a few months, and sometimes they don't come at all. So a charnel ground is a place where you can see different levels of decay of the body. But that's not something that we can do readily here, so I'm not going to go into it. Now, we're going to be getting into the observation of feeling. And how monks, does a monk abide observing feeling as feeling? Here, when a pleasant feeling, a person understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. What is a worldly pleasant feeling? I want an answer. Come on. Ice cream.
Chocolate.
It's a pleasant feeling at one of the sense doors. And taking it personally. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. What is an unworldly pleasant feeling? Getting into the jhanas. I had a friend that had been teaching meditation for 20 years, and then he started coming to me because he wasn't satisfied with it. And after a few days in the retreat, he comes to me with this glowing face and this smile on his face. And he said, after 20 years of teaching other people meditation, I finally know what a pleasant abiding is. Well, what kind of meditation had he been teaching? But he really thought that that was something. When feeling a worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. What is a worldly painful feeling? Well, that's some. It's a painful feeling at one of the sense doors. Now remember, mind is one of the sense doors too. When feeling an unworldly painful feeling, what is an unworldly painful feeling? Exactly right. What's a meditation pain? It's a pain that comes up and it's really intense. But when you get up and you start walking, it goes away in about, well, less than a minute. That's a meditation pain. The interesting thing with this kind of feeling is it's not physical, it is mental. All feeling is mental. Oh, but it hurts in my knee. No, it's actually in your mind. Okay. when feeling a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. A real pain doesn't go away. So I don't want you to sit like that anymore. I don't want you to cause yourself physical problems. That's one of the reasons that I have you walking, and walking in a normal way, so you get the exercise. In Asia, they have this idea that everybody's supposed to sit on the floor. But the Asians are starting to be westernized, and in their houses, they sit in chairs. They don't sit on the floor, they sit in chairs. And they go to work and they're sitting in chairs. So they're starting to get used to sitting in chairs. And then it comes time to do meditation. They think they're supposed to be on the floor. And they get a lot of pain by being on the floor. Well, don't do that. I don't want you to sit with pain. Pain is not useful to your progress in meditation. It will come. When it does, you have to know how to siksar it. But I don't want you to cause pain to arise. Sit in a chair. Sometimes you want to sit on the floor, sit on the floor. But sitting on the floor continually causes a lot of pain to arise. I know, because I did it for 20 years. Not really. It was about 15. Then I couldn't do it anymore. See, I don't know if you've noticed, but you see me hobbling around, and I have swollen ankles. And that's because I was sitting on the floor, and my teacher said, "Why don't you sit longer?" Okay, I just started a retreat. Went to the first interview. How long did you sit? Sat for an hour or walked for an hour? That's what I was used to. Okay, sit longer. Yeah, I can do that. Okay. Come in the next day. How long did you sit? Sat for 2 hours, walked for an hour. Okay. Why don't you sit longer? Yeah, okay. Come in. How long did you sit? 3 hours, walk for an hour. It was a real killer. Why don't you sit longer? Oh, man, okay. So I come in. How long did you sit? I sat for 4 hours. I never want to do that again. Did you move? Well, yeah, I was moving all over the place. It hurt. Well, don't move. Oh. I come in the next day, tears coming down my face. The pain is so intense. How long did you sit? Sat for 4 hours, walked for an hour. I'm never going to do that again. Why don't you sit longer? No. But he kept after me. And I got so that I could sit for 6 hours, and then I got so I could sit for 8 hours. And getting up and doing slow walking. I mean, slow walking. From this wall to that wall took me 45 minutes, one direction. Because I was walking so incredibly slowly. And I didn't get exercise. And as a result, I got blood clots. And I've had, for the last 20 years, I've had problems with the bottom of my feet being swollen and tender, and swollen ankles and swollen legs. So I don't recommend that. Although you can sit for long. But when I was told I was pushing, I was forcing myself. I went through immeasurable amounts of pain. And after Well, after about 4 hours, the pain goes away for about an hour, and then it starts up again and gets more intense. But if you don't sit on the floor, because my legs were like this, and you got these little hoses running around in your body called veins, and they get a crimp in them, and then a clot forms. And then you get out and you start moving, and it's stuck. So it's really not recommended. That's one of the reasons I want you to make sure you get enough exercise. It's really important. And you'll hear me harp on it the whole retreat. Walk faster. Don't want you to run. That's hard on your knees. But walk more quickly so that, and walk long enough so that you're breathing through your mouth if you're sitting long. 2 hours, that's not what I consider a long sitting. But when you get up to 3 hours or 4 hours, I want to make sure you got enough exercise. Okay. When feeling a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands I feel a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. What is a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling? You've been listening to my Dhamma talks. Indifference. You don't pay attention, but your mind's kind of ho-humming. Okay. When feeling an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. What's an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Come on. Equanimity. When you get into jhana, you're starting to develop your equanimity, even in the first jhana. But when you get to the fourth jhana, then your mind has a very strong equanimity. Now, the reason that this is unworldly is because it is jhana, and your mindfulness is very sharp. Okay. So now we're going to go into the observation of mind. And how monks, does a monk observe mind as mind? Here a monk understands mind affected by lust as mind affected by lust. And mine unaffected by lust as mine unaffected by lust. He understands mine affected by hate as mine affected by hate. Mine unaffected by hate as mine unaffected by hate. He understands mine affected by delusion. What's delusion? Taking things personally. So what is this actually saying right here? It's a different way of describing mind affected by craving. Okay? Okay. He understands contracted mind as contracted mind. What is a contracted mind? Sloth and torpor. And it really is. Your mind contracts on it. Your mind is like really cold butter, and you just get some brand spanking new bread out of the oven, and you try to spread it, and it just doesn't spread. That's what your mind is like. And you say, yeah, but I get so sleepy. But you have to relax. Well, how can I relax? How does it arise? What happens first? What happens after that? Start paying attention to how it arises, not paying attention to being caught in it, but how does it arise? You'll start picking up your energy little bit by little bit, and before it goes away. When I was in Burma, there was two monks that were foreign monks, and they were sitting on each side of me. Always during the same time of the day, both of them would be, I used to call them my bobbing bookends, because I wasn't doing that. I'd already learned the lesson of sit straighter. Don't lean in the chair. Sit so it's your back is straighter than normal. And when your back starts to slump, your mindfulness will catch it. And you'll be able to straighten up. And that's how you start picking up your energy. And it doesn't last very long when you do that. But also walking backwards is very helpful. Okay. And he understands distracted mind as distracted. What's a distracted mind?
Restlessness.
Now these two things, you better be fairly friendly with them, because they're going to stay around until you become an arahat. Take an interest. How do they arise? What happens first? You won't get caught for as long when you take an interest in how this process works, not why it works in one way or another. Now, one of the things that's real interesting is that people don't realize the planning mind is restlessness. At the end of every retreat, the last day or so, everybody starts thinking about, oh, I'm going to get off the retreat and I'm going to go tell this person what a great retreat it was, and I'm going to say this and they're going to say that, and then I get to explain all this stuff to them. And when you get off retreat, it's not even close to what you had planned. So your planning mind, you tell it, I don't need to think about this now. I'll think about it later. My job is to observe what mind is doing right now, not get caught up in it. Okay, he understands exalted mind as exalted mind. What is an exalted mind? Say it again. I didn't hear.
Exalted mind?
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe the person was exalting himself. And
No.
It's the, like a feeling of loving kindness, like radiating loving kindness.
It's the first four jhanas.
Each one or four?
All of them. That is an exalted mind. Now we're going to get tricky. He understands a surpassed mind as surpassed. What is a surpassed mind? It's the arupa jhanas. You're surpassed the four jhanas. Actually, the fourth jhana has four different sections in it. And that's why people start talking about having eight jhanas. It's not actually eight jhanas. It's four jhanas and four parts of the fourth jhana that you keep going deeper infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, neither perception or non-perception. He understands the collected mind as collected. What's a collected mind? Getting into jhana, staying on your object of meditation. As you start to get more used to this practice, you'll start being able to stay with your object of meditation for much longer periods of time. And when you get up to, say, neither perception nor non-perception, you'll be able to sit without having any disturbance in your mind for an hour, hour and a half. Except, I have some students that they'll sit and there won't be anything. I mean, there's nothing. Nothing disturbs mind at all. And they'll go, well, nothing's happening, so they get up. One of my students took 3 years for me to jump up and down, pull my hair out, and say, stop doing that. Ah, but I've got so much more to do. You don't have anything more important than what you're doing. You're making a huge amount of merit because you don't have, your mind's pure. You don't have any disturbance in your mind at all. Finally, they start listening. And then they start getting the true benefits of the meditation. Okay, and he understands a liberated mind as liberated and an unliberated mind as unliberated. So this is also taking you to the different stages of awakening. I don't call it enlightenment. I don't like the word enlightenment because if I tell you something you don't know, I've enlightened you. But when you become awake, you're no longer in that dream state. Now you're starting to see the way things truly are. Okay, now we're going to get to the observation of mind objects. And lo and behold, the first part of this is the five hindrances. The hindrances are your teachers, remember? But if you're practicing one-pointed concentration, your hindrances, they're your enemy. You got to push them down. You got to stop them from coming up. And how, monks, does a monk abide observing mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual pleasure in him, a monk understands there's sensual pleasure. There being no sensual pleasure, he understands there's no sensual pleasure. Now, listen to this part, because it gets tricky. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen sensual desire. And how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen sensual desire. And how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual pleasure. Okay, so we'll go to the first one. How there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen. We'll call it any one of the hindrances because it does the same thing with each hindrance. How do you abandon it? How do you abandon a hindrance? Six are. Okay. And how there comes to How there comes to be the abandoning of the sensual desire, how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen sensual desire. How does it arise? Lack of mindfulness. Okay, your mindfulness gets weak for whatever reason. All of a sudden, a hindrance is there, right? And how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. How does this part happen? Staying on your object of meditation. It's pretty simple. You lose your mindfulness, hindrance arises. You 6R the hindrance, your mindfulness gets stronger, and then you stay on your object of meditation for a longer period of time. And I have read a lot of books about what do you do with the five hindrances. And all of them are talking about beating them up and pushing them down and forcing them away. And that's not the Buddha's way. The Buddha's way is never with force. It's always with acceptance. Allow it to be there. 6R it. Smile, come back. Okay, now we get to the five hindrances, or five aggregates, excuse me. And how does a monk abide observing mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five aggregates affected by craving and clinging? Now, the interesting thing with the five aggregates, if your mindfulness is sharp, you won't be affected by the craving and clinging because you're staying on your object of meditation. These aggregates can arise. There will be a feeling, there is perception, there is your body. There is formations, there is consciousness. Now, an interesting thing here is that actually feeling, perception, and consciousness are conjoined. What you feel, that you perceive. What you perceive, that you cognize. Cognize is an interesting word because it means seeing as it happens. Recognize has memory in it. You recognize. So these five aggregates are actually three aggregates. You have body, you have feeling, perception, and consciousness, you have formations. Then we go to the six bases. And how does a monk abide observing mind objects as mind objects in terms of the six internal and external bases? Here a monk understands the eye. He understands forms. He understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. What is that fetter? Come on, you have to start talking back at me. Come on. What is it? What is that fetter?
Craving.
Craving, that's right. But you heard her say it first.
It doesn't mean it wasn't in my mind.
Okay, I'll believe you. Okay, and he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen fetter. How does that happen? We just went over it. Lack of mindfulness. Mindfulness goes away. Not staying on your object to meditation. How there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen fetter. Six R's. How there comes to be the future non-arising of the abandoned fetter. Stay with your object of meditation. And that happens, he understands the ear, he understands sound. He understands the nose, he understands odors. He understands the tongue, he understands flavors. He understands the body, he understands tangibles. He understands mind. He understands mind objects. And he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. And then we go through the whole thing again. Lack of mindfulness, it arises. Use 6R and then stay with your object of meditation. Now, this is the Satipatthana Sutta. There is another version of this sutta called the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. And the translation in the Digha Nikaya is very poor. It is supposed to include all of the links of dependent origination in when it's talking about the six bases. And it goes through with the mind objects that way, and it really shows more deeply how important understanding the links of dependent origination really is. This is the backbone of the teaching. And in each link of dependent origination, you have the Four Noble Truths. So the Four Noble Truths go a lot deeper than what an awful lot of the teachers are talking about these days. And we'll get into that in the next few days. Now we have the awakening factors. And how does a monk abide observing mind objects as mind objects in terms of the seven awakening factors? Here there being the mindfulness awakening factor in him. A monk understands there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. Or if it's not there, he knows it's not there. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness awakening factor, and how the arisen mindfulness awakening factor comes to fulfillment by development. Now, this is real interesting because of the awakening factors. You have mindfulness, investigation of your experience. Okay? You have energy, you have joy, you have tranquility, you have collectedness, and you have equanimity. In the Samyut Nikaya, it talks of a lot of suttas on the awakening factors. And there are a couple of them that I truly like is, what do you do when sloth and torpor arises? Okay. You start developing your mindfulness awakening factor. You develop your investigation of how it arises, and you adjust your energy. That's the first three awakening factors. When you do that, joy arises. Now, this kind of joy is not going to have excitement in it. This kind of joy is just going to be a really happy feeling. What do you do when you have restlessness? Then you take the last three awakening factors. Bring up a feeling of tranquility. Bring up a feeling of collectedness, stillness. Bring up a feeling of balance. And that's how you can use the awakening factors in your everyday practice. Okay? Now, the last part of this talks about the Four Noble Truths, and I prefer actually to talk about the more Four Noble Truths in a more comprehensive way than just saying, well, there's the first one and then there's a second one. We'll get to it when we get to dependent origination. So we have a conclusion here. Monks, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits can be expected for him: either final knowledge here and now, becoming an arahat, or if there is a trace of craving and clinging left, non-return. That means anagami. Let alone for 7 years, monks. If anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way, for 6 years, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, one of two fruits can be expected for him: either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of craving and clinging left, non-return. Let alone 1 year. If anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 months, 6 months, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, half a month, one of two fruits can be expected for him: either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of craving and clinging left, non-return. Let alone half a month. If anyone should develop these four foundations in such a way for 7 days. How many days are we at? Do we have left? Four? Still got time. Still got time. One of two fruits can be expected for him: either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-return. So it was with reference to this that it was said, monks, this is a direct path for the purification of beings, for surmounting sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of a true way, for the realization of Nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. When I used to give this sutta, it took 2 days. I've cut it down a lot. Do you have any questions? Yeah.
When you talk about
Well, the object of meditation is loving kindness, or mindfulness of breathing, Or I've had some students, they wanted to stare at a candle. You can do that as long as you have 6 R's. One-pointed concentration means no 6 R's. No right effort. Okay, right effort is recognizing an unwholesome state when it arises, releasing the unwholesome state, excuse me, and relaxing. Bringing up a wholesome state, smiling, and coming back to your object of meditation. Staying with your object of meditation for as long as you can. That's right effort. When you're practicing one-pointed concentration, there's a couple steps that are left out. One is no relaxed step. The relaxed step is absolutely essential to attain nibbana. Why? Because that's craving. A lot of people will talk about craving, but they don't know how to recognize it. They don't know how to let it go. And this shows you. Simpler. Oh boy. The tightness that arises in your head has to be recognized as tightness and relaxed. Now what happens, the feeling that when I first started doing this, it was really, really strong. I would relax that tightness and it felt like there was an expansion that happened in my head. And then very peaceful and calm. I didn't have any kind of distractions coming in. And then bringing that back to the object of meditation. That's what I did when I first started doing this. And one of my students wrote on a little piece of paper, he said, this is what you're teaching. And it was release, relax, re-smile, return, repeat. And I just added one more, recognize. That relaxed step, I don't care what kind of practice you're doing. If you put that relaxed step in, it's going to change your entire meditation. You go to India, you have all of these gurus that are teaching one-pointed concentration and all of these the talk of psychic things. I don't know that they really happen or not. But that's because of one-pointed concentration. Now, in the suttas, interesting thing, because it starts talking about psychic abilities, and some of the psychic abilities are real, and some of them are taken from the Visuddhimagga and put in. Some of the psychic abilities are the divine eye, the divine ear. The divine eye, you can see heavenly beings, asuras, this kind of thing. But whenever somebody gets to a certain place and they start talking about having the divine eyes, I test them. I don't believe what they're saying. And the first time I did it, I was really impressed. Because I told this mother, I told this lady, I want you to go to my mother. She lives in California. I want you to tell me the name of the street that she's on. I want the address of the house, and I want to know what color she's wearing right now. And she told me. And I called up my mother and I said, what color clothes do you have on right now? It happened to be blue. And she said, blue. I said, thanks. I hung up on her. She called me back, of course. What was that about? It was just a test. The divine ear, you can start hearing what other people are saying from a long distance away. You can start, and this is something that turns into kind of a hassle until you get used to it, is being able to read other people's minds. I have a lot of monk friends that are very adept at that, and we have conversations without speaking. And it's actually kind of neat. But the thing that's really interesting is they don't speak English. And I don't speak their language. But I hear what they're saying in English. I don't know how it happens. Don't ask. But these kind of things can happen. I'm good at sending thoughts. I'm not very good at receiving. See, there's basically three kinds of personality in the world. There's people that are very, very intellectual, but they're not sensitive to feeling. Usilananda was like that. He was real big on doing loving-kindness meditation with guided meditations. He started asking me how I taught loving kindness meditation. He couldn't get the feeling. He was extremely intelligent. He was like Sariputta. And Sariputta, he had no psychic abilities at all. I have another monk friend that is very sensitive to feeling. Not near as intelligent, but very sensitive to feeling. And he could hear thoughts and these kind of things. And that's more like Moggallana. He was more sensitive to feeling. And then there's the kind of person that's like the Buddha, which is fairly well balanced between sensitivity to feeling and intellect. Most people are that way. People that are truly sensitive to feeling, they have a hard time growing up because they pick up other people's feeling and they think it's theirs, and they're highly emotional. And when I get them as students, they're a real challenge for me. Because it's real easy to start thinking your hot stuff when you can do this stuff. Another of the psychic abilities, you can fly in the air. And I'm not talking about just popping up off the ground this far. I'm talking about actually flying from one place to another. You can do that. But all of the monks that I know could do that, they always told me to go at night so people couldn't see you. Like I could do it. I think it would be great fun, but I don't have that kind of abilities. No, I'm physically. It's more comfortable to take an airplane.
Yeah.
One of my teachers was Manindra, and he was a little Indian man. And he came to visit, and this is right when Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was teaching people, quote, to fly. And I said, Manindra, what do you think about this flying? He said, how much does it cost? He said, $2,000? For $2,000, I can fly around the world. No problem. That was back in the early 80s when you could do that for that price. So it kind of depends on your natural sensitivity to feeling whether you're going to get psychic abilities or not. Now, getting back to one-pointed concentration, there's a sutta in here that talks about this one ascetic. He sat in meditation along a stream, and there was 500 ox carts that went across the stream, and he didn't hear them. So he got kind of famous for that. And somebody came to the Buddha and said, that's pretty good, huh? What do you think? And the Buddha said, well, last night I was meditating in a barn, and lightning struck outside and killed two oxen and a couple of people, and I didn't hear any of that. And he said, do you think that ascetic could say something like this? He said, no, I don't think so. The Buddha was sitting in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness. He didn't know anything. There was no consciousness. He was just sitting in meditation. That was it. And when he got up in the morning, he found out, look at what happened. I think he was kind of lucky it didn't hit the barn. But there's a lot of talk, especially in India with the gurus. I did a meditation and I didn't move for 1 month. I don't believe it. They're the ones that get up at night and go get something to eat and drink and then go back and sit down and say they hadn't moved.
What's the point anyway?
Bragging rights. But the Buddha is real big on don't talk about this stuff. But when you get together with other people that you know or suspect have the same level of understanding, you can talk with them about it. Because if I talk to you about what my experience is, my complete experience is in meditation, you're going to put me on a pedestal. I don't like being on a pedestal. And you're going to talk about, he's an arahat. I'm not an arahat. I guarantee I'm not an arahat. But I don't talk about what my personal experience is very often. It just surface stuff. But I recommend that for all of you. Because somebody else doing a different kind of meditation is going to come along and they're going to say, that's not what this experience is. This experience is different than what you're talking about. And they'll try to convince you that you don't know what your experience was. So it's better just to talk with your spiritual friends. I taught a man in Korea, South Korea. And he did pretty well on his meditation. He got to neither perception or non-perception. But he couldn't wait to get off retreat so he could go tell everybody how good he was. And I told him, Dave, don't do that. But he did it anyway. I can't control that.
But I don't understand what the value is of sitting there and not knowing what's going on right beside you.
I had a student, or I had a teacher that could sit for 7 days, and she did. And I said, why? Why sit for 7 days? She said, relief. Not having any disturbance bother you while you're sitting in that state. There's so much relief in that. And as you start to go deeper in your meditation, you'll start to see more and more. It's worth it. Not having a hindrance arise. Think about that. Oh, yeah, well, wouldn't that be nice? And to do that for, and to do that for an extended period of time. Oh, yeah, nice. It's worth it. Yeah?
Your story about the teacher who kept asking me to sit longer.
They think that's the right way to do it.
How could anyone interpret that from the Buddha's teachings that
there's look at, we're 2600 years after the Buddha. There are corruptions. There's a whole, you go to Tibet, they have all of these ideas of the way they thought the Buddha taught. You go to Burma, they have all of these ideas of the way they thought the Buddha taught. You go to Thailand, they have their own ideas. You go to Sri Lanka, they have their own ideas. So there's a lot of cultural things mixed in with it. But we go back to the, as close to the original as we can. And even some of these suttas are wrong. They're absolutely, no doubt about it. They were added later. And there's no agreement with other suttas. It's just standing alone. So I don't take that sutta as being from the Buddha. The thing with the Buddha's teaching is it keeps on, everything just interconnects. And he's talking about something in one particular way, and then he talks about it in another way, and you start comparing, and you go, oh, you're saying the same thing, just different words. But when it comes to doing it and seeing for yourself whether it's right or not, then you will have unshakable confidence.
That is a feeling that we are making conditions right to arise? Is that what we're doing when we are making that feeling of loving kindness?
You have to have something wholesome to come back to. Okay? And you can do mindfulness of breathing, but the mindfulness of breathing, to get where you're going to get at the end of this retreat, with mindfulness of breathing might take a month and a half or 2 months. This particular thing, and this is a meditation that is taught more by the Buddha than mindfulness of breathing was. Okay. There's a lot of suttas that you only hear the first part of, and the rest of it is doing the loving kindness and doing the Brahma Viharas. But it's letting go of the unwholesome and bringing up the wholesome until it becomes habit. And once it becomes habit, then you walk around with a grin on your face all the time.
So then we're learning skillfulness.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of the Tibetan ways of describing things are really right on. I mean, skillful means is staying on your object of meditation. And I like that term. And a lot of those terms are very, they help with the definitions. So don't be afraid to use those terms. Okay? Yeah?
The practice that we're doing, isn't there some bit of suppression of the hindrances in what we're doing?
No.
None?
No. Because you're not getting involved with the hindrance. The hindrance arises because you broke a precept in the past, whether it's this lifetime or another lifetime. It doesn't matter. But it comes up because you felt guilty, okay, and you took it personally. And then when it comes up, there is that craving that's attached to it. And when you let go of the craving, then that hindrance doesn't have any more juice to it. And it'll just fade away by itself. But it's not, doesn't have anything to do with suppressing. Suppressing has force in it. There was a book a few years ago that was Power versus Force. And what you want to do is learn the power of relaxing, of letting go of the craving. There is no force in it at all. Some people try to use the six R's as a stick to make things stop and make it go away, and that's not doing it correctly. And it was like I was telling you the other day, some people, they have so much pain and suffering come up. Release, relax, release, relax, release, relax. This doesn't work. Well, you're right. It doesn't work if you don't use the whole six R's. If I give you a recipe for making the best cake in the world, and you only use half of the recipe, and then you try it and it tastes like dung, Then you come to me and say, well, that was a lousy recipe. Well, why was it lousy? You didn't follow the directions. You didn't follow what it said. You need to put this in a particular way. Do that and you will be successful. And that is a for real. You will be successful. I promise. That's a strong statement. But it's for real. Why do I know? Because I have 3,000 students that are going around the world going, you got to do this stuff. This stuff is fun. And I'm so happy now. You think of Indonesia. They're extremely overcrowded. They can't get enough food. They have a lot of hardship. They come and start practicing. They start getting happy. And as they get happy, benefits start coming to you. When you keep your precepts without breaking them, it's a protection. And when you take care of Dhamma, Dhamma takes care of you. And that's for real. I know because I've lived that way for 30 years. I don't have any money to speak of. But with all the cabins and the building I've done on the land, it's getting close to $750,000. Well, how can you do that? You don't have any money. I don't worry about it. I take care of the Dhamma. Sometimes people will come out of the blue and say, well, I want to donate $50,000. Okay, fine. You can do that. I don't care. I'm more interested in having you be happy. That's really what I want. I want to see everybody smiling truly from their heart, not only while they're here, but while you're interacting with other people. That's what makes this fun job. It does work. And that's why when I went to Indonesia, I just got off the plane. Go to a house, there's 100 people waiting to offer me food. 100 people. And they're not all old toots. They're young people, teenagers. They're seeing the advantage of doing this. If you look at the Vipassana students, you go to a retreat that has 100 people in there, there's a lot of gray hair. There's a lot of people that have been doing this for a long time. But they aren't as successful as they could be. What's the end result of their practice? If the end result doesn't lead them to prosperity and happiness, they're doing the wrong practice. How can I say the wrong practice? Well, some practices will only lead you so far, and then they'll stop. Other practices can lead you a little bit further, and they'll stop. Some practices can take you all the way. That's what I started looking at when I was really down about the successful conclusion to me of Vipassana for me. I started looking at what's the end result. I didn't feel any happier. I still had a lot of suffering. Still had a critical mind. Still had a hard mind. But I'd gone through all of the insight knowledges. So I concluded that the end result of that meditation wasn't what the Buddha was talking about. And because I accept the fact that I'm dumb, I want to find out. And that's why I kept digging and found this. And it's not my method. It is the Buddha's method. It does work. And it is simple. Don't make it complicated. Oh, I've been talking for a long time. Last question.
Could you go over drops?
Don't resist or push. Soften, smile. Yeah, I got that from one of Stephen Levine's book. And he was a person that worked a lot with people that were dying. And he had a student that was, his body was just giving away. And sometimes he would have really extreme pain. And that's when he came up with drops. Don't resist or push anything. Just soften your mind and smile into it. Okay, I've been talking for a real long time. So why don't we share some merit? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we've thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.